You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 1st to the 7th of September 2016. My name is John Elms and I'm joined today by Deputy News Editor John Morgan and reporters Matthew Rice and Chris Havergal. And in the news this week, some of England's most prestigious universities are mulling over opting out of the Teaching Excellence Framework, according to a new THE survey. Chris Havergal has been looking at this and will fill us in about it in a shorter while. By signing up to Free Movement, non-EU Switzerland became a research powerhouse. But a referendum backing restrictions on immigration means it could lose access to EU research funds. With the UK in a similarly precarious position after Brexit, John Morgan took a trip to the Alpine Nation to see what lessons could be learned. And finally, Matthew will be taking us through our second feature, which explores what it meant for an opera scholar after a lifetime of seeing the world through a critical eye to be moved by a piece of art. But first, Chris, you've been looking at the results of a THE survey which could have significant ramifications for the TEF.
Yes, I mean, ever since plans for the TEF were announced, universities, and in particular the country's most prestigious universities, have raised a number of concerns about the exercise and the impact it will have on the sector. But it still seems to have been largely assumed in the sector that every institution ultimately would sort of grin and bear it and take part in the exercise, not least because it offers you the chance to put your tuition fees up. However, you know, discussions in recent months are starting to indicate that maybe the pendulum is swinging back a little and some universities are actually considering whether it will be worth their while taking part in the TEF, or indeed whether the risks of taking part outweigh the potential benefits. I've conducted a survey of the Russell Group's 20 English members, and so far only three, that's Bristol, York and UCL, have confirmed that they'll participate in the second stage of the TEF. That's the stage where providers are assessed on areas such as retention, student satisfaction and graduate employment. 16 said that they were yet to take a decision on their involvement, and Oxford said it would announce its position once engagement with the government and sector bodies is complete, refusing to say whether they actually had taken a decision or not. I mean, of course, there's a bit of brinksmanship going on here. You would expect so many more of those Russell Group members to ultimately take part in the TEF. Nevertheless, there are suggestions that a number of institutions, a number of England's most prestigious institutions, do have more significant concerns to the extent that they may consider opting out of the TEF. Those are likely to be institutions which are led by vice-chancellors who think that the TEF is going to be such a burdensome exercise that an inflationary fee increase probably wouldn't cover the costs and the burden of taking part. Or those institutions who fear that the metrics that are being used probably not ones which are going to show them in such a glittering light as they're used to getting from their research performance, and a concern that actually if they underperform, that could be used against them internationally. In that sense, you know, the risks of staying out are probably a better option than the risks of going in.
Yeah, and I mean, you said that the suggested they would, they'd probably end up, most of them would probably end up participating in the TEF. What would be the consequences if they went, nah, we're not doing this?
Well, I mean, for a starter, they'd have to keep their fees at £9,000 a year. Doesn't sound like a lot when you think 2017-18 will be £9,250. It could build up over time. However, you might think that the institutions that might stay out are those, potentially those, that could probably increase recruitment to make up any shortfall, or feel that they're financially stable enough as it is, that £9,000 is a fair fee. I mean, I think there's actually an interesting question here about reputation, because if maybe, you know, one or two institutions don't go into the TEF, it might be damaging to their reputation. If some of the really top players in the country don't go in, or if maybe several, a decent handful of top universities don't go in, it becomes a question of what's the damage to the reputation to the TEF itself. and does it actually start to undermine the TEF as an exercise? I'm not saying we're necessarily there at that stage at the moment, but it does show the sort of brinksmanship that's likely to happen. The full details of the TEF are yet to be fully confirmed. Joe Johnson, the university's minister, will, I'm sure, want to get the sector on board, and in particular get those top universities on board. So it may well be these are the sort of issues that are being fought out as the final details are being thrashed out, and ultimately that may be what decides the university's final position.
Absolutely. John, you were smiling when Chris was saying this. Are you something that you wanted to?
Just the point that it would be very embarrassing for the government if it were missing these very prestigious universities, a bit like the Checker Trade Trophy, making a great fanfare of attracting Premier League B teams and then falling flat on its face when very few of them actually wanted to join.
Absolutely.
The question I wanted to ask is, I mean, isn't there a danger that it's perceived that that these universities kind of are saying, well, we don't actually care about teaching, or it could be used against them in that kind of way.
Yeah, or it could be portrayed that they're running scared from something which they know they feel they're not going to do very well in. THE conducted an analysis of how the TEF might play out, or at least how the metrics might play out earlier this year. And actually, most of the top performers were sort of small campus universities and post-92s. I mean, what you would most likely see would be universities focusing very much on their concern about the metrics and whether they actually reflect excellent teaching and a good student experience. If you speak to people more privately, certainly those issues around reputational impact and whether the fee increase is worth it suddenly become much more prominent.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Chris's story can be found on pages 6 and 7 of our magazine, yet another example of our HE system potentially being at odds with government policy, but that's nothing new here. John, you've been looking at the Swiss HE system and what the UK can learn from it as it faces up to life outside the EU, though we haven't left yet. What have you found out?
So Switzerland's universities have experienced a sort of massive impact from the crisis in relations between the Swiss government and the EU over the issue of immigration. And that's interesting for a couple of reasons for British universities. And there's some lessons they might want to learn from what's happened in Switzerland. Firstly, you know, Switzerland has up till now been an associated country in EU research. It's not a member state, but it takes part in EU research programmes. And you know, Switzerland shows the value of that associated status, but also how the EU can use negotiations over associated status and research as a political weapon in much, much bigger and much more complex political issues. And secondly, you know, universities across Europe have reaped the benefits from free movement in terms of mobility for researchers and students, but Switzerland shows you know, what can happen when that free movement comes under question from voters who are worried about immigration, and shows the ways in which universities can be hit. So I went to Switzerland and spoke to people, including the president of ETH Zurich, which is continental Europe's highest ranked university in the THE World Rankings, and also senior figures from the Swiss People's Party, which is the right-wing political party that drove the movement to have the immigration referendum in Switzerland. And to sort of briefly sum up what's happened in Switzerland and how the crisis came about, in 2014 Switzerland had a referendum on whether to restrict immigration from the EU, and voters sort of very narrowly backed limits on immigration by 50.3% majority. And then the EU reached, well, after that, then the government decided it couldn't ratify a free movement deal with new EU member Croatia because of the referendum result. And then the EU reached for the nearest weapon to hand, which was the deal then under negotiation for Switzerland to take part in the EU's latest research programme as associated country. And it was sort of kicked out of those talks and then sort of let back in a little bit with a partial association to Horizon 2020, the latest research program, which lets Switzerland take part in the European Research Council. But basically, the Swiss government has to fully ratify the free movement deal with Croatia by February 2017, or it's going to be kicked out of Horizon 2020 completely. And Swiss universities are extremely worried about that prospect.
Absolutely. Forgive me, but what we THE have reports on in the run-up to Brexit and post-Brexit is how the HE sector will particularly be hit. I mean, you said that the Swiss universities are really worried. I mean, to what level are their levels of concern?
In that Switzerland is a nation that relies on innovation for its wealth. So if Switzerland can't be part of Horizon 2020, then it's not part of the ERC. So that's a highly prestigious system of grants. So it's not going to be able to attract the leading researchers to come and work in Switzerland anymore if they can't work in Switzerland with these grants. It's a university like ETH Zurich really relies on international prestige. It's going to be, its reputation is going to suffer if Switzerland is kicked out. More broadly, it's damaging to the economic health of the nation if it can't take part in international research in the big challenges affecting the future of Europe.
Sure, and for the potential consequences on UK institutions for Brexit, are we likely to see a similar situation bearing out? Say we can't agree with an immigration deal with an associate in a new country?
Well, when I spoke to Alistair Jarvis, the university's UK deputy chief executive, who's leading its work on Brexit, a couple of weeks ago, so I've asked him if he thought it was likely that the EU would tie associated status in research to free movement as it did with Switzerland, and he said yes, he thought that was quite a distinct possibility. So you need to bear in mind what's going to be politically achievable, given that it looks like Theresa May wants to end the current free movement arrangement. So is it going to be possible for the UK to get associated status in research? So perhaps the case of Switzerland suggests that the UK might have to look at the prospect of life outside the European research system if free movement is not an option for the UK government.
So it looks like the UK HE sector has got its work cut out to lobby the government to make sure that doesn't happen, otherwise we could be struggling.
Yeah, I think free movement, so the political issues around that are a lot bigger than universities, so they're only a very, very small voice in the debate around immigration.
Of course, of course. John's piece, should you wish to read it, I'm sure you do, can be found on page 36 in the magazine. Obviously got some hard-hitting ramifications potentially for UK HE and beyond. Matthew, last but by no means least, of course, you're going to take us through quite a personal piece, a completely different tack to what we've been discussing.
It could not be more different.
By one of our frequent feature contributors, Nicholas Till. What is his piece about?
Well, he's a professor of opera and music theatre at Sussex, and this he describes how he was at the Venice Biennale Art Festival, and one of the things on show was a video of a sort of Polish opera which was being performed in a village in Haiti, where there happens to be a small Polish community, and he said he was just incredibly moved by it. He suddenly felt very, very emotional. And on the other hand, he describes an opera he saw about 9/11, which was full of sort of worthy emotions, and all the mainstream press thought it was great, and he thought it was absolutely awful and it's going to completely dry-eyed. And I suppose the key point he's making is that, people in the humanities tend to study things that they feel passionate about and very emotional about initially. And then the way they study them is often very detached. And I mean, opera is obviously a sort of art form of the ruling classes. So a lot of writing about opera is not about, how it's great. You'll have a few laughs and a few tears. It's all about, race and class and gender and sort of critically examining, often in a rather judgmental way. And he's saying, you know, isn't this actually rather strange? And we do, you know, he and many other people do respond very emotionally. And in a way, that's the point. And somehow there ought to be a way of writing about the arts which acknowledges this. So I think it is raising some quite interesting issues about the how the humanities work. And he's a wonderful writer, and it's a very vivid but very personal piece, and not dealing with the great issues of our time. My colleagues have this week, but it's still highly recommended.
No, absolutely. I mean, you mentioned the fact that he's obviously watched plenty of opera in his time, and the critical eye is to be dispassionate but explain why one might feel a certain emotion as opposed to I feeling this emotion.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And that is quite often quite difficult for academics who have to look at something in such minute detail, especially in the humanities, and then that might detach their own emotion.
Yeah.
So is he saying that there's a place for, you know, potentially his tears on the page as he's writing?
Well, I think so. In a sense, that's what he's written here is an emotional piece. But there is room for not just, doing these class and gender and race analyses, which can get a bit predictable. And because, you're getting away from it's getting you away from what made you interested in the first place.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the things he's really writing about.
Absolutely. And as Matthew said, it could not be further away from HE policy and Brexit, but it is still a wonderful piece and can be found on page 44 in our magazine. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for this week's issue review, but as always, complete coverage of our latest HE news features and our book section can be found on our magazine and our website, timeshighereducation.com. If you'd like to make a comment on any of the issues discussed in our podcast or any of the content of this week's issue in the magazine, you can do so via social media. We're on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn and our website. Alternatively, if you wish, you can drop us an email at the.letters@tesglobal.com. Until next week's issue review podcast, however, I wish you goodbye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.